Okie dokie. I'm in Utah. You know, I've talked about this on the podcast so many times. There's been this like years long saga with my teeth. I didn't have dental insurance for years and years. And then I got dental insurance a few years ago. And this dentist was like, there's so many problems in there. We've had two teeth extracted. We've had root canals, the gamut. It's been this whole thing. My anxiety hates going to the dentist. It's a whole, I have to go to Utah where they can put me under to do these. I had a massive panic attack at the dentist. Two of them, huge, some of the biggest panic attacks I've ever had. It's been a whole saga. If you've been a longtime listener of the show, you've been following along. If you're just getting here, that's the nuts and bolts small version of it. But anyway, I had a root canal the other day here in Utah. The last couple of days, the tooth has just been in extreme pain, which is weird after a root canal because I feel like they killed the nerve. I shouldn't be feeling all this pain. Anyway, I had planned on doing this episode with my mother while I was in town. I brought all my gear, all my podcasting gear out. I said, hey, I'm coming out. Let's do this episode on service. And I forgot my second microphone. And so I told her this morning, I was like, I don't have the second microphone. My tooth's killing me. I can't even think straight. I got to go get this thing fixed. I don't think that I can do the episode. And then like, I don't know, we were sitting and chatting and the mood struck me and I thought, I know how to talk to my mom. We can sit here and we'll make it work. And so this is a first. I'm passing the microphone back and forth between my mom and myself. And so you might, I just want to say that as a listener, you might notice some strange audio things because we are sharing one microphone and passing it back and forth. I think I did a pretty good job though. I think I did a pretty good job of getting the microphone back and forth so that you can hear who you're supposed to be hearing each time a person is talking. This is also a first. Usually when I do the intro part, my guest is no longer in the room with me, or they're gone, or we're off of the whatever, if we're on a Zoom call or we're streaming, whatever. I usually do the intro part by myself, but my guest is standing right across from me. She came back in, like, this is now 2 hours after we recorded the interview, and she had something that she wanted to make sure, she felt like she didn't say this. So, Julie, what did you want to say that you feel like you didn't get to say in the interview?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that I appreciate my husband more than you know. And the fact that he allows me to be the crazy person that I am, bringing people into my home and our home and adopting extra people into our family constantly, he's always on board. He's just fine. You know, when I want to do service or something, he's totally on board. If we want to give money to something or whatever, he's just as much excited about it as I am. So I just want you to know, and him to know if he's listening, that he's my partner in crime.
Well, you know that he will be, he will listen to this episode. And I do think that you mention him in the interview more than you realized. I think from my perspective, and I think the audience will hear this, and I think everyone when they listen to it will hear that, like, you mention him more than you probably even know that you do. But she wanted to make sure that it was really clear that she's not the only person in the relationship or in the family leading the service charge, that she has a very service-oriented partner who is my father, and that is true, and they make a very good partnership in service. But yeah, that's what we're talking about. You clicked on the episode. You saw the title of the episode. We're talking about service. I don't really have much else to say. I just took some ibuprofen and some Tylenol, and my tooth is feeling a little better. It's feeling a little less swollen. Hopefully in a couple days, it'll feel a lot more better. I can't keep taking ibuprofen and Tylenol. I can't poop, you guys. Do you know that? Do you know that if you take too much ibuprofen too many days in a row, or maybe it's the acetaminophen, I can't remember, know which one it is, you can't poop. And I can't poop right now, and I gotta poop. You gotta poop. I gotta have a tooth that doesn't hurt, and I gotta be able to poop.
And everybody's running to the bathroom right now.
Yeah. And everybody, if you're out there and you're taking too much Tylenol or Advil and you can't poop, that's why. It also sometimes gives you heartburn. If you have heartburn and you've been taking a lot of Advil, Tylenol, that might be why. So let's do it. Hey, Julie, do you think you could say the intro to this show after listening to it for so long? Do you think you could recite it? Do you know what it is? From a Blanket Fort recording. So try it. Try it. Come here. Let's see if you can say it.
From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser with Austin Archer.
Hey, that's it.
Oh my gosh.
From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my guest,
Julie Archer,
my lovely mother, about
service.
Service. Okay, this is very strange. I messed up. I came out here and I said I wanted to talk to you, and I have two microphones, and I got all my stuff packed into my backpack, and my cables, and my cloud lifter. I have two of these. I need these to make the microphone work. I had two cloud lifters. I had four cables, which is what I need, and I only brought one microphone. So I was like, I don't think we can do it. But then I thought, we'll just do it like TV interview style. So I'm sitting right next to you, and we're going to have to be very careful about taking turns talking.
Okay.
That was perfect. That's exactly right. I'm going to talk about that much, and then you always just say one word.
Okay.
Perfect. Just like that. We have the conversation goes. I'm sitting here with my mother, Julie Archer. We're talking about service. There's a lot of people in the world right now who need help. There's this thing going on in Hawaii that we're looking at that's heartbreaking, and in Maui, and it's just terrible. You're a person who to me is like the exemplar, supreme of service in the world. Service is a big part of my recovery and sobriety. It's a big part of like how I stay sober. But when I think of service, I think of you. I think of you as a person who has like devoted her life to serving other people and to being of service. Why? Yeah, you do a big wide-eyed look at me, but obviously we're talking about this. So like that.
Well, it makes me feel like maybe I don't deserve it sometimes. I just think everybody serves people. And I just feel like when you say that I'm a person of service, I think, doesn't everybody do that?
You don't think that you serve people any more or less than anyone else?
Not always. No, I don't. I just feel like that's something, it's innate in people, and it's some people have more time to do it than others, but I don't feel like it's any special thing. So thank you for thinking that.
I think most people who know you and know you well would disagree with that assessment that you have of yourself. That's why I'm talking to you about this. And I think that you hear it too when you have people over to your house every year for Thanksgiving and stuff. And you have this very large family that goes out beyond just your children and your grandchildren. You have all these extra people that always are coming in too, that you're always inviting into your life. And I think hearing it from those people, it does seem like you do. Don't you think? Okay, so whether or not you agree that you do service more than other people or anything like that, don't you agree that service is a very important thing to you?
Oh, yes, definitely. There have been times in my life that I thought, what do I want to be when I grow up, or what do I want to do with my life? And I think when I feel that and I feel stuck, I feel like the most important thing I could do right then is go do something for someone else. And so I just think in the morning, who needs me? Who might need me today? Or look for opportunities to better somebody else's life if I feel stuck.
Where do you think that comes from, though? Where does that impulse come from? Is that something that you were taught by your parents? Is that something that you think comes from your religion? Were you ever told? So like for me, I was taught service, obviously, growing up in the LDS church. But like as a tool of my recovery, my sponsor and other alcoholics in my program tell me, they're like, if you're stuck in your head, just like you just said, if you feel stuck, go and help someone else, and it will get you outside of yourself. And so it's sort of this practical tool that I use to just sort of get outside of the spinning hamster wheel of like me-centered thinking. Where do you think it stems from for you?
Well, I do think I learned an awful lot of that from my religion. I think we are taught, I think it's a very service-based religion. We all do our turn serving in capacities that we might not even know how to serve in, but we do it and we learn. But I don't think I was very service oriented when I was younger. I think I was just very, just like anyone else, very self-centered, worrying about me and growing up and progressing and whatever. Then you become very service oriented to your children. But I think what's happened for me is the hard times that I've been through have taught me I wish somebody would have been there for me when I went through that hard time. And then I went through another hard time. I wish somebody would have been there for me. And you grow as a person every time you go through something hard. And so now I've become much more of a person where I look outward rather than looking inward because of the things that I've been through in my life. Many, many surgeries that have put me down and thinking, this is really hard. I don't like living like this. Well, there's people that live with injuries and illnesses every day of their lives or hardships every day of their lives. And people need to be there for them.
Well, and as long, my whole life, you have been there for people who deal with, you know, physical disability and stuff. There's always been people involved in our life and in our family that we were regular fixtures that you were like, I'm here for this person. We had Kemma, we had, you know, like there's always, and you said this thing that's really interesting. You said there have been times in your life where you thought, I wish someone was there for me when that happened to me. So maybe that inspired you to go be there for someone else when it was happening to them. Have there been people, though, in your life who showed up for you in moments where you needed someone to help and it made you want to pay it forward in that way?
Oh, yes, for sure. I have best friends, I mean, that when we have a funeral or when we have a wedding or when we have anything that's very difficult to plan or to... I have two friends, Shauna Williams and Cleo Cohen, that we are there for each other. We know when we are, when we're needed, and we literally will drop everything for each other and make a meal for a funeral or help plan the whole wedding or whatever. You know, we're just there for each other. And it's been a really, it's been great. And I have other really good friends too. The wives of my husband's friends, when he was growing up, they've all been great. We all stick together and help each other and we're there for each other through thick and thin. But, and then one time I had an experience that was really, really telling for me. Austin might've talked about this, but, his sister has had some, I guess we would call it emotional.
We haven't talked about this on the podcast. I don't know if I have ever talked about this on the podcast. I was going to have her on the show and talk about it at some point, but she is manic depressive bipolar and had a kind of a psychotic episode when she was a teenager.
Yes. Yeah. And she's doing great. I mean, she's she's amazing. But when it was happening, I was...
And she's probably listening too, and we love her very much. And, love you, Allie.
And she's one of the strongest people I know going through what she went through. But when it was happening, it was so new to me. I had no clue. And I still had little kids. I still had children at home. And all of a sudden, there's this thing happening. And all of a sudden, we've got to rush her to the hospital. And I was just, I was beside myself because I didn't know what to do. And I didn't know how to handle it. And I came home. And I still cry to this day to think about it because there were two ladies in our religion. They call them visiting teachers or ministering helpers or whatever.
That's the new language, right? Is ministering.
Ministering, which I don't like that title for some reason. I just don't appreciate it. But I appreciate visiting. I would call them visiting angels. How's that? If they really do their job. Because this couple of ladies... Literally, I came home and there was a full meal spread out on my counter and I just cried because I was just so exhausted from having to take her and leave her at a hospital and still come home and know that I needed to be a mother to my other children. And I didn't have an ounce left of energy in me and I needed to still be there for my children and be strong for my children. And I came home and they didn't even know. I don't know how they knew that this happened and that I was rushing my daughter to the hospital. And I came home to this beautiful pot roast dinner sitting on my counter that was, and I'll just never forget it. And another time, when my dad died, we had family that was all coming in and it was overwhelming. You have all these people at your house and another visiting teacher, visiting friend of mine, what wonderful friend, just showed up with soups, three or four different kinds of soups, breads, crackers, cheese, all this spread, and just laid it out on my counter and just said, I hope this helps, and just left. And I thought, what amazing. And so I learned from that, and I've done that. I've paid that forward. When I've heard somebody having to go through a funeral, my husband and I will go to Costco and just buy a spread of food, just breads and meats and fruits and cheeses and, you know, desserts, drinks, whatever, and just fill a huge box full of food and leave it on their doorstep. And that's more helpful. I sometimes think people think, what can I do? I have no time. I can't think of anything. I don't know what they would need. Or they will say, call me if you need anything. Mm-hmm. They're not going to call you if they need something. They just aren't. That's just people. It's just not in people's nature. So the best thing you could possibly do is do something. Jeff and Sharon are really good that way. Jeff and Sharon Quinn, they will go to Costco, buy a bunch of stuff, bring it over. I hope this helps. You know, they.
Well, I think that that's also, you know, culturally speaking, again, like, I think Mormons are good at that stuff. Like LDS people are, and I know that's not the term anymore, Mormons, but like, I still, Like I say this when I'm in the world abroad, that I'm like, no, like Mormons are good at showing up in a pinch. If you're moving, if someone's falling on hard times. And I think that in general, that is one of my favorite things about religion in general, is the idea of fostering community and a gathering place for the neighborhood, for the community to be, to say, hey, sister so-and-so was just diagnosed with breast cancer. It might be nice if someone wanted to go by and maybe make dinner for, you know, for her and her family this week at some point, just so that we're showing up as a community. And I think that's really beautiful and like really, really useful. I think where religion usually loses me is with dogma and stuff. Yeah, and yeah, but yeah, like you guys have all these great friendships. You're talking about Cleo and Shauna, and like these are like close to 40 year long friendships now. And even just recently, I was over here and you said, we're going over to help Cleo move things around in her basement because she's worried about flooding because the river was rising in her backyard. And so we just went over there and we just spent an afternoon just helping her move stuff around, because that's what you guys do for each other. And that's a big part of your day-to-day, your life.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, people have to understand that you benefit from service as much as the other person does. That's something that I've always had in my mind, that I've benefited from it. I've gained more people in my family. I served a Micronesian girl. I was a substitute teacher at Brighton High School, and saw this girl and got to know her and befriended her and found out that she was in a terrible situation living here. And through my service-oriented brain, I'm thinking, I've got to do something for this girl.
Hold on. So I have a question. I have this written down. I wanted to talk about her. First of all, I'm not ever really sure about the details. What was she? Was she just like on a foreign exchange program, or what was the situation that she was in?
No, her brother had lived here, and her brother, the family that he was living with, he just said, do you know a family that my sister and my cousin can come over and live with? And they just placed her in this family. Little did he know that they weren't going to be as warm and as friendly and as kind as the family that he was living in. So it was a bad situation. It was a sad situation. I think they were willing, but they weren't willing to go the extra mile. They came with, you know, tank tops and sarong skirts and had no warm clothes whatsoever. And they took them to DI on one run and took them. I mean, and that's a, like a Goodwill type of a place, and got them a coat and some boots, but they just hardly had anything. And they wouldn't even give them a key to the house. So when it would be snowing outside, the girls would sit outside waiting to be let in the house. I mean, it was just a really not a good situation.
Well, this is why I say that in my mind, and I think in the minds of people like Kathy Matthew and that you are a person who goes above and beyond, because for this family that was willing to take on Kathy, and was it Margaret that she was with? Or yeah, Kathy and Margaret. I mean, that's a lot to be asked by someone, hey, will you take on these two extra mouths to feed, these two extra kids? And they probably maybe were trying to do their best. I don't know. And they just weren't, you know, but like someone like you comes along and I'm like, does it even cross your mind? Like, does my family have the capacity to take on this other person? Do we have, I mean, obviously we had the space in the house that we were living in to take on one more person, but, or is it just an instinctive thing that you see her and you go, I can take good care of that girl. I should.
Oh, absolutely. It was just instinct, but it was also Adam came home from school one day and he said, I saw this girl. I know who she is. Mom, we need to help her. I mean, he said the same thing. So I knew that at least one child of mine was willing and ready. And it was a month away from Christmas. It was a crazy time of year to take a teenager into your home that you don't even know. And then I put her in, you know, the extra room that we had, but Allison hadn't even met her. She was at college at the time. So all of a sudden we've got this new member and it's a month away from Christmas. I had to go out and buy Christmas presents for her and get her clothes, get her everything. We did her dental work. We did, you know, we taught her to,
a lot.
We taught her to drive. I mean, she had nothing. She had nothing. She came with nothing. So, I mean, we were happy. We were happy that we had the means to be able to help her. But, you know, things like that, I think people look at it and go, I can't believe that you would be able to do that, or you would think to do that. Well, to me, it's like, I can't believe that you wouldn't. That's my brain.
Yeah, I don't know that, I'm not sure that everyone has that instinct or that muscle. Like, I mean, I don't, like, I want the audience to understand, like, I can't understate this. Like, it's not like my mom, you know, said some nice words to this girl. She's still my sister to this day. This was 20 years ago, longer than 20 years ago, and she still lives here in Utah. We are still incredibly close with her and her husband, and her. You view her son as your grandson, and they come over and spend holidays with us still to this day. She's still for all intents and purposes, you are her adoptive American family, mm-hmm. and her adoptive American parents. And I mean, and she calls you mom to this day. She calls you mom and she calls dad. And I still call her my sister. I tell people that I have this sister who's Micronesian and they're like, oh, is she adopted? I'm like, well, when she was like 16, and she has parents, like she has Micronesian parents too, but she just has lived with us and, you know, for a very long time. But I mean, like, we have the same, like, she's not the only one. You have a French son. You have a kid who came over for a foreign exchange program, was supposed to be here for a year, and he's still here.
That story was pretty funny. We, my husband speaks French and went to Quebec on his mission, his Mormon mission to Quebec. So he speaks fluent French. And my daughter was at her friend's house one day, and she was in high school, and she said that Jamie got a call, and they said, we've got a foreign exchange student here that somehow they got double booked, and this kid has no place to go. He's here from France, and he went to this home, and the home already had a foreign exchange student. They had no place for him. Do you know of anyone that could take him? And my daughter was there, and she said, us, we can do it. We can do it. And my dad speaks French. We can do it. And so I had to call him, say, is it okay if we take this kid in? And in a half an hour later, he was at our house and we took him in. And
flash forward to 25 years later and he's still here. But like that, I did not know that Allie volunteered our family for that service.
Well, she asked. It wasn't like she went, we're going to do it. She just said, yeah. I've got to go home and ask my family, but I think we could, you know.
But that's also very much who Allison is. It's like, so I don't know if this comes through the female gene better in our family or not, because your mother was very service-oriented too. I don't know, because I'm like, I feel like it's something that I really have to, like, put a lot of it. We call it contrary action in the program. I never want to do service. I always like want to just do what I want to do. And I have to like be very intentional about like just simple things. Like, let me just call another guy today and ask him how he's doing. Let me just call someone else and ask them what's going on in their life. I really have to focus on it. And it feels like for people like Allison and yourself, like you just sort of go, oh, if that kid doesn't have a place to stay, How about he just comes and lives full time at my house, and I'll let him, I'll buy extra groceries for him and get him clothes, and in 10 years he can get married in my backyard.
Yes. Yeah. I've done both of their weddings too. Yeah. So, and that really is a sacrifice, because it's hard to put on a wedding if anybody's ever done it. I've probably done seven or eight weddings. Mm. And it's a lot. But I enjoy it. I mean, that's another service I totally enjoy, but it's a lot. I think we should talk about the time we were on the airplane coming home from New York.
Yeah, this is insane. And I barely even remember the details of this, I think it's just because it's so commonplace for you. It's the kind of things that we were in New York, and we came home, and there was some, we were at the airport. Were we at JFK or were we at Salt Lake Airport?
No, in New York.
In New York. Some girl looked lost, and we just started talking to her. She was going to Salt Lake. She had a job lined up at like a McDonald's in Provo or something, but she didn't know where she was going to stay. And so naturally.
What happened was she heard us say we were going to Utah, to Salt Lake City. So she started following us in the airport. She just was this little blonde, cute little girl. And she started following us, and she was literally following Austin. And I thought, what is she doing? Finally, I asked her, I said, Are you okay? Are you lost? Are you whatever? What are you doing? She's from Kiev, Ukraine. And I said, oh my goodness, what are you going to Utah for? So she starts telling us the situation. She was going for a internship to work there at McDonald's in Orem, Utah. And so I said, that's great. So we talked to her on the way home, get to the airport. And I said, so now what are you doing? Somebody picking you up? And she said, Oh no, I'm just going to go find a hotel and hopefully I'll be able to call somebody tomorrow. I said, no, you're coming home with us. So she came home with us, and everybody went, of course she came home with us, Mom. You know, of course you did that. But the next day was Mother's Day, and she had no idea what Mother's Day was because they don't have it there.
Yeah.
And I remember her.
And you were furious with her for not having a present for you.
Yeah, I was.
No, but
you kicked her out of the house. You said, how dare you?
No, I remember we had a picnic because that time we decided this is going to be easy because we'll just have everybody bring picnic stuff and nobody will have to work hard on Mother's Day. And we had this picnic and everybody was saying something nice about Mother's Day. And I remember the words that she said, I don't have Mother's Day in my country, but if we did, I'm happy that you have this, and I'm really happy to know your mother, that kind of thing. And what I ended up having to do was I called down to McDonald's. They had no idea that she was coming. So I had to go down to Orem, down to the McDonald's, raise holy hell. I mean, I'm not kidding. I had to get crazy and say, get your manager in here. And they were like, no.
You had to get your Karen on. You
I
had
did.
To go and get the manager.
Oh, I did. I was very angry because this girl came all the way and they were all like, we don't know anything about this. I lost it. And they got the person there. They went, oh, well, our schedule says that she's not supposed to come till the fall. I said, well, evidently your schedule is wrong or she's wrong, but you need to do something about this.
She's here now.
She's here. So they had to figure out that they had this home that they were going to put all these kids in. And right then they had a kid from Russia. So she goes off and goes and lives with this kid from Russia until the other kids came. And she did call me a couple times that summer and said she was having a good time, but she just couldn't get over how green and beautiful Utah was and how she said, my city is just white buildings, white cement. I see cement every day, just big, huge buildings and no green. And yeah. She just couldn't get over our mountains and how beautiful it was. And, you know, so it was a good experience. I think it was a good experience for a whole family.
She didn't wind up, you know, a 20-year
no.
child of the family like the other people.
I would like to know where she is and how she's doing, but I never did keep in touch that close a touch with her.
Sure. I will tell a story really quickly about how this can go wrong, because I think that I got this. I got a little bit of this from you, and I try to emulate what you do, and I try to pick up strays in my life. But I had this one time where I was living downtown with my friends in a punk house, and there was a hitchhiker on the side of the road that I saw. And my friends, we used to let people, we'd let like punk kids who were hopping trains and like were riding trains across the United States, they'd come and stay with us and they'd stay on our couch and stuff like that. And I think I got that from you. I was always like, yeah, whoever, we got room, we got couches, people can sleep here, whatever. And I see this girl and she's hitchhiking, and I pull over and I go, where are you going? And she goes, where are you going? And it's one of those scenes where if it was in a movie, the audience would totally know what was happening before the characters knew what was happening.
I thought that very thing. I thought if she said, where are you going? Hello. Right then and there, you should have known who she was and what she was looking for.
I was so earnest. I was so like sincere. I was just trying to be of service. And so I said, well, I'm going home. I said, but where can I take you? And she said, I'll go wherever you're going. I really should have known. I just like, I'm such a naive, like young, bright-eyed chap.
That just shows me that my son has never used a prostitute. So thank you. Thank you for letting me know that.
They're called sex workers now, Julie.
Sorry.
But yeah, I did pick up a sex worker and I brought her home to my house, and I didn't know that was what was happening for the longest time. I told her I was going upstairs to smoke a joint with my friend Tucker. And I did. I said, you can come upstairs if you want. And she came up and followed me upstairs, and she started taking her clothes off. And Tucker and I went, what's going on? And she went, are we doing this or not? And I went, I think there's been a misunderstanding. And that's how I found out that I, in trying to be a good guy and be of service, try to be like my mother, I had accidentally picked up a sex worker.
And you said, do you still want to stay over?
I think I did. I was like, you can stay. And she was like, no, 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 no.
Oh my gosh. That shows me that I really raised a very kind, naive son.
You talked about how you get stuff back when you're of service, that you feel like it like you get as much out of it at least as the people that you're helping. What do you feel like? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think sometimes people like have a cynical attitude towards the idea of like charity or service and being like, oh, you're only doing it to make yourself feel good. And it's like, yeah, so if that's a residual effect of helping other people, there's a line in the musical Avenue Q when it says, when you help others, you can't help helping yourself. And I'm like, love that line. Like, it's just like you can't help but feel better about yourself. If you're having self-esteem problems, that's another thing from AA, as they say, if you want better self-esteem, you need to do esteemable acts. And so if you want to feel so I don't know, like how does being of service make you feel? Do you have any stories of like when being of service to someone lifted you out of a rut that you were in, or a place where you felt stuck?
Well, every time. I mean, my husband and I had really some cool experiences. Is cool even a word anymore?
People say cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nobody
cool likes Tucker Carlson.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And I love that song. Yeah. We worked 5 years at a detention center, and those are kids that are waiting to be sentenced with, they've stolen cars, they've robbed homes, they've run away from home, they've
killed,
we had one that murdered his girlfriend.
Yeah.
So 5 years of this, and every time, there wasn't a time that we didn't come home and feel like we gained more than they did. What our assignment was to do was to go and teach a kind of a non-denominational kind of a faith-based lesson on a Sunday morning. And then we would go on I can't remember if we went Tuesday or Wednesday, but we'd go in the evenings and play games with them. So we would do things like cornhole and cowboy golf, and we'd do relay races with them and just fun things. And then we'd take a treat, and then we'd kind of just sit around and talk and get to know them. And every single time we would come home and say, that was the best. That was so good. And now we haven't done it for years, and we were missing it. And we just got the invitation to do it again. And this one's at the County Health Child Services, and it's the Christmas box house. And if in Utah, people know what that is. It's children that are displaced from their home one way or the other, orphaned, or if their parents are drug users and end up in jail or whatever, or the children are being waiting to be placed in the foster care, one way or another, they end up there. So they have the Christmas box house has children 12 from toddlers, babies to 12. And then there's a couple other centers on the campus that are teenage boys and teenage girls. And we've worked with the children, we've worked with the teenage boys, we've worked with the teenage girls. And right now we're kind of been working with the teenage girls more often. And they're getting to know us and they're getting to know our names and getting to, you know, look forward to when we come. And we don't even teach anything religious to them. On Sundays, we teach a life lesson that is like, teach a lesson on kindness, teach a lesson on honesty, teach a lesson on using ideas and how to, I did one on the scrub daddy and how, the person invented it and how that's just such a simple invention. But that person, if they hadn't used their idea and put themselves out there, they wouldn't have made an invention. So I was trying to show them that they, you know, I bet you have ideas, and they did. They came up with really amazing ideas. But I feel good every time that I come home, and I don't feel like they benefit from me as much as I benefit from them every time.
I feel the exact same way whenever I work with newcomers in the program. Like, I don't know if I'm ensuring that they're going to stay sober, or if like what I'm saying to them is like getting through, or if like I'm helping them at all. But I feel like it helps me. Like, I get to see myself in them. I see a lot of clarity in them. And when I talk to them about our mutual problem of addiction or alcoholism, and they're so early on with trying to get sober, I hear so much of my own story when I talk to them, and I'm reminded that I have the same problem that they have. And so it feels like a raw deal, because I'm like, I'm trying to help. I'm trying to offer what I know at 5 years sober to these people. But also I know that at that time, stuff can go in one ear, out the other, or they might not be at a place where what I'm saying even makes sense, because it's like, and I remember like people with more time than me early on telling me things, and I didn't know what they were saying until later on. So I always feel like I'm taking away more from the interaction. And I do tell newcomers that too. I'll say, I'm going to call you tomorrow. Will you do me a favor and answer? Because you'll be helping me if you answer the phone.
Yeah, I feel that way with the kids. I think, am I making a difference? Doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. I just feel like it's beneficial for them to see that I showed up. You know, and it's beneficial for me to show up, to say, I followed through. I said I would do this. I'm going to do it. I like, there's a guy that has a service that's called Because I Said I Would, or something like that. It's got it on a t-shirt and everything. And they do service type things because he told his dad, I think before his dad died or something, he said, I will do whatever because I said I would. Mm-hmm. And that's the type of person that I want to be, is to show up because I said I would. That's important to me, and that's important to instill in my kids. My husband always says the most important thing in your life is to show up. Just keep showing up and making the effort to be the person that you think you want to be or say you're going to be. Just show up.
I agree. It's huge. I am trying to build a case here, because I know that you're not going to just say like, oh yeah, I'm a very good person and I do all this, but like we're building the case for the audience. So we've talked about Kathy, we've talked about Cyril, we've talked about this girl from the Ukraine, we've talked about, these kids that you work with at the detention center. Tell me about your relationship with Nan and Emma.
Nan was, I taught at a private school. This lady started a school, and her children are very exceptional students. And so she started a private school, and Nan was my aide. And she was this little mousy, would hardly even say yes or no, or hardly talk to me. And she was my aide, always there every day, showed up, very, very timid. And came to find out that she was in kind of an abusive household, and I became her friend. And in the time that we became friends and working together, She came to me one day and said, what would you think if I was interested in a polygamous man? And I said, does he treat you well? Because I knew she hadn't been treated well in her life. And she said, oh, yeah, he's very kind. And I...
Well, she's from a polygamist.
No.
Oh, I thought that she was from a fundamentalist LDS lineage.
No.
But okay, so she...
There is some way back in the lineage, but not in her particular family.
Yeah, and a lot of us have it way back because that's the roots.
Mm-hmm. But she, she hadn't. And so for her, she felt like, is this going to be okay and whatever. And so I kind of encouraged it because it was a better situation than what she was in. Mm-hmm. So they went to Montana and did, I can't even remember, some kind of ceremony. And then when they came back, I loaned her Allie's wedding dress and I picked flowers and made her a bouquet. And he wore a suit and I took them out in my backyard and took wedding pictures of them. And I made it a big deal because I thought she's going to be happier in this situation than she was in her own. And she ended up in that situation. There's two other sister wives and they were not kind. I mean, let's just say it's very difficult. It's a very difficult situation. And she's this third person that comes into this situation. He's always been wonderful, but it's been a very stilted relationship to be there.
People ask me about this a lot still to this day. I mean, just like when I meet people in Los Angeles and stuff and they find out that I'm from Utah and they sort of jokingly ask, do I have more than one mom? But I also know that they're half joking and that they're actually curious. Like, and I mean, I just still think that a lot of people don't understand that like the mainstream LDS church that I was raised in, that you go to, that you practice in, does not practice polygamy, but we do live in Utah. There are kind of compounds and communes of people who are they identify as fundamentalist Latter-day Saints, and they still do practice polygamy. I just want to make that delineation.
Yes. And I, from what I understand, the more wives, the more celestial you will be, the more... And anyway, so I got to know her, really, really got to have a close relationship with her. She ended up having a baby and almost lost her life with that because she ended up having it's a form of Addison's disease where the stress level was so high in her body that any kind of chemicals or any kind of foreign anything, smoke or... she has to sleep with a ventilator in her room and any type of thing shuts her body down. Her whole face will go Bell's palsy. She can't breathe. She can't talk. It happens all the time, but she didn't understand it. The hospital didn't understand it. She almost died before she had Emma and she ended up having this darling little girl. And so we became close again because for a while there, I lost a little bit of track of her, but we became close again. And I just have made her part of my family. I mean, I look at it and think it's the only, I will say, quote unquote, normal bit of life that she has. We invite her to stay over on Christmas Eve. They don't celebrate Christmas, but we do. So I invite them over so they can have a nice Christmas morning. We invite them to our birthday parties. We invite them to Thanksgiving. We invite them everywhere.
Little secret people don't know is that the war on Christmas isn't actually being waged by liberals. It's being waged by fundamentalist Mormons.
Not necessarily. I just honestly think that they've got so much going on that they just can't do all of the stuff.
Too many people.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I believe that's what it is because birthdays or anything, nothing happens. So it's just, I don't know what they believe, whatever they believe, but Emma is now 20 and Nan is just works her tail off. They both work very, very, very hard and Emma is very, very intelligent, got a full ride scholarship to Utah Valley University and they just struggle to make ends meet, but they do it. And Alma is the dad and he is very supportive and very good to both of them. And that's as much as I can say.
I mean, Alma's been, I think, as supportive as we possibly could have hoped with how much our family gets involved and wants to have Emma and Nan in our family. I think Alma's very, standoffish or proud about it. Like, hey, that's my wife and my kid. We don't need your help, but he allows us to not only have a relationship with them, but to help. he accepts the help, which I think is a thing that's hard for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And we've also just considered them part of our family now. I consider Nan a sister from another mother, and I love her as much as I love my siblings. So, I just have that kind of relationship with her. And Emma, I just care about her as much as I care about my own children. She calls me Aunt Julie and my husband, Uncle Mike. And for the longest time, we were Mr. and Mrs. Archer. They could not get over not calling us Mr. and Mrs. Archer. They just couldn't do it. It was just the formality in their upbringing, in their world, that they couldn't get over that. And I have to be very forceful with her to say, stop being what you think your world is teaching you need to be. And they've become very funny, cynical, outspoken people because I've taught them to be.
You've taught them to be very cynical.
Yes, I love it. No, even Alma is becoming that kind of a person because she's so cynical and funny and just comes up with really funny quips.
Do you mean like sarcastic? Because yes. Cynical's like cynical's negative. Yeah.
No. But she even has that side to her a little bit, but more sarcastic, very funny sarcastic.
Yeah.
And that was not in her before. It was really beat out of her when I first met her. So.
Yeah. And these just two more people that this is what I mean is like, you know, it's such an interesting thing. We get together every Thanksgiving, like a lot of families do, but there's always, so you have four kids, three of them are married. And between those three, marriages, there are 15 grandkids. So we've got a lot of, I'm saying your kids that came out of your vagina are four, and then on top of that, so you've got that. If that's all you had to deal with at Thanksgiving, that's a lot of people. But then you've got Kathy and her husband that come over with Khalil and her child. You've got Cyril and Chelsea that might stop by on any given Thanksgiving and are there frequently. You've got Nan and Emma. That's two more people. And from frequently we have like Shauna and Mark might come by with it, you know. And like, so we've got all these extra people that are joining in, and that's just how my life has been my entire life. I wonder, is there anything that you intentionally do with your space, with your home? Do you put energy into focusing on like cultivating a space that feels safe and welcoming and home-like for people who, regardless of whether they're blood related to you?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like my home should be a safe place for people. I think it should feel not... I've gone into homes. I think all of us have gone into homes where we feel like, can I sit there? Can I touch that? Can I, you know, how do I act? Do I need to whisper while I'm in this home?
Yes.
Our home is very loud, very, very loud and accepting, and very animals are on the furniture. Kids jump on the furniture.
Shoes on.
I mean, if shoes are off, shoes are on. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's that type of thing. And I used to care.
And it stays clean in here. I think your home always has been proof that you don't need to be so uptight to keep a nice home. Because I think that Dad would always like the home to be even cleaner than it is. That's just the kind of guy he is. But I think that this, your home, the home I grew up in and this home have always stayed really well kept for how much you let your grandkids run all over the place and haven't, don't really worry about if people are wearing their shoes inside the house and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think I'm a little more anal about my house down in St. George because we have a pool down there and I just go crazy when there's wet swimming suits sitting on the furniture and wet towels on the floor and things like that. To me, there's got to be a boundary of saying, I've got to let my children feel comfortable here and let them know that they can just be themselves. But at the same time, be respectful. Be respectful of the fact that we want to have these things, our furniture last a while and be able to come down here and know that our home's going to be here and it's still going to be in good shape. And I want, so I have a few little things that bug me.
I just don't think it's anywhere near the level that it could be. And I think, but well, you just sort of let the cat out of the bag there for some of the audience members when you just revealed that you have a second home, vacation in this economy, Julie.
Gosh,
they were on your team.
I know.
They were on your side. And then you said that and now they're like, oh, I get it. So she's just, but that's another thing that we could talk about is like, if anyone is listening to this feeling like, oh, geez, I'm not doing anything service-oriented in my life, there's also a certain amount of availability that you have for service when you have some amount of financial prosperity in your life. And since your husband has always done well in his – always did well in his career, there was this – ability there was, you always knew that there was room in the bank account maybe for these extra people, or maybe not. You're shaking your head.
No, there was a time when I was doing anything I could with second jobs, whatever, and just making ends meet. And we had football players come and live with us in that summer, and they paid us $100 a month, and that maybe paid for 1 week of their groceries. You know, it was, we've always had people live with us one way or the other, whether we can afford it or not. It was not an issue. I always had all the neighborhood kids in my home, and they would literally go into the cabinet and get a treat or whatever. And it wasn't an issue to me, but, and I always couldn't always afford that. But it just...
I had, like you're saying, though, like I grew up with friends who... I grew up with shoes off houses and houses where I didn't feel like I could touch things and houses where, like, treats were off limits because it was like my, you know, like there's a... Those are on a budget, and you, if friends come over, they get one treat. And our house was never like that. And I agree with you. There were times, I mean, like, you know, Dad lost his job when I was in fourth grade, and I remember him selling phone cards out of machines that he kept in his office in his basement. And like, we were doing whatever we could to keep that house with that we had, and to, you know, to keep things going. And you've got these, not only your four kids that you're taking care of, but you always have these other people coming in. So there have been tight times, but don't you think that you've been blessed?
For sure. My life is way more, I mean, both of us, my husband and I, were both raised in a very, very lower middle class homes where both of our parents worked. And we both really, our families struggled enough to make it.
That's the key. That's it right there. Sorry, I'm taking this back from you.
Oh.
Since we only have one, that's the key, is that you both come from homes that are like, neither one of you was raised wealthy.
No.
And I think that both of you experienced together a level of prosperity that far surpassed
exactly
what you were raised in.
We do
and
not.
So that's where that desire to go, oh, we've got more than enough, mm-hmm, comes from.
Yes. We don't have the silver spoon syndrome because we didn't have a lot. So to me, anything extra, I mean, most of what I have is extra. So I'm perfectly happy to give it away or to share it. Because, and I mean, I share my home, my second home, I share that all the time. I mean, I have a cleaning lady from Brazil, and she's, I love her. And I'll just give it to her for a week and say, go down, and if you want to straighten up some things down there while you're there, great. But if you don't want to, I don't care. Go for a week. I have a girlfriend that's divorced, and her daughter lives with her, and I give it to her for a week for her birthday in the summer. I can give that house away. I don't have a problem giving it away to people that need it. And people just look at me like, I can't believe that. You don't rent that house out. And I'm like, no, it's my home.
There's so many wealthy people with extra homes who have two or three or four homes, and those homes spend 9 months or 10 months out of the year empty. And they're just like, well, if I'm not there, no one's there.
No.
And that is my house. And I'm not letting, you know, but like, there's always someone at your St. George house, mm-hmm, every time. So I drive back and forth from LA a lot, and I always have to ask you guys, is anyone at the St. George house? Cause I like to stop in St. George and spend the night cause it breaks up the drive nicely. But there's frequently someone staying there.
Well, and you also have to know that several years ago, home prices were not what they are now. So when we were to get in a second home, it was much, much, much more affordable than it is now. So those houses are paid for, you know, I mean, they were incredible. And now everybody's moving to St. George, and they're becoming untouchable. So to have a second home is not what you think it is. What it used to be, very, very, very affordable. So it's different than what maybe some states would think.
I guess I'm just trying with this whole area that we've gone into. I guess I'm just trying to like talk about, because I also like, I've talked about this on the last few weeks of the podcast, that I'm just like, the reason I think that billionaires are among the most immoral people in the world is the excess amount of wealth that they hoard is so unfathomably large, and what they could do with that wealth. And I think about the kind of people that I was raised by, and the fact that you always had enough to get by, and frequently had more than enough to get by, and were always the first thing. It almost seemed like the first thing that you would do once you had something extra that you were blessed with abundance in wealth, is share it, is find someone who could use it, is find someone who could benefit from it, rather than just keeping it in some place. And I don't know who, like, you know, like, it just always seemed like you were like, let's figure out a way to make sure that the abundance that we experience gets to be experienced by the most possible people. And I feel like the mindset of so many of the wealthiest people in the world, whether they're billionaires or hundreds of millionaires, like a lot of the people in the AMPTP that my union is striking against right now, their mindset is, let me keep the abundance in the smallest closed off possible group as possible. I want this is mine and my kids' money, and no one else's, and no one else is entitled to it. And there's a lot of people that really believe in that philosophy, that like, it is theirs and it is their families, and you don't deserve any of it. And it's like, technically you're correct. Technically they get to decide what happens with that money that's in their name and with that wealth that's in their name. It's just so insane to me that they don't go and buy up a bunch of residential real estate and house it with unhoused people, and put and just go, I have more than enough money to take care of this problem by myself. I have more than enough money to wipe out the medical debt of like 100,000 people. I could just pick 100,000 people and go, I'm going to wipe out your medical debt, and it's not even going to affect me. And I could do it like that. And I feel like if you and Dad were ever worth anything over $50 million, you would be doing stuff like that all the time.
I wouldn't feel good keeping that kind of money. I just wouldn't. It's just not in either one of us to say, oh, well, we deserve this. I can't stand it when somebody says, I deserve that. You know, no one deserves anything more than anybody else. Everybody deserves happiness and food and clothes on their back and a warm place to sleep, and everybody deserves it. Nobody deserves anything any more than, but I hear people say that. I've worked hard. I deserve that. I want to slap them and say,
I think I call it Republican brain, and I noticed it happening to me that I made very little money most of my adult life. And the moment I started making more money, I felt it's like a virus, and I felt it. These intrusive thoughts start to come in that go, okay, this is pretty good. How can I get more? And not only how can I get more, how can I keep more? So now I'm looking at like tax angles and things like that. And instantly I was like, oh my God, it happened so quick. The second I started making more money, I started thinking, how can I keep more of this money? And one of the ways that I stave that off is by trying to stay rooted in service and by being willing to be giving with what I have. So like I am much more comfortable picking up the tab at dinner and things like that, and just trying to remind myself that like, that's okay. Right now I can do that without sweating it. And I know that my friend who I invited out to dinner maybe is sweating it a little bit more, and I don't want them to have to, and it's okay. And I can share right now. And I have more than enough for me to be comfortable, so I can make this.
But you have to be okay with the fact that some people just don't feel comfortable not knowing that there's a certain amount in the bank or in wherever it is, because they don't trust the economy, you know, blah blah blah, whatever's out there. We have to be okay with that some people really are so financially insecure that they've got to live their lives that way, and it's okay. We have to be okay with that.
I think there's a certain amount that it's reasonable. Like if you personally own in assets or investments somewhere in the neighborhood of like $350,000 to $1 million, and that's what you've got in like assets and investments and bank accounts and stuff like that, and you're going, I know that sounds like a lot of money, but I'm trying to hang on to it as much of it as possible because I don't know what's going to happen. I got kids, I got bills, you know, I think that that's okay. I don't look at that and think like you're hoarding wealth. But I think when you get into the neighborhood of anything over like $50 million, $100 million, $200 million, you get up to $1 billion, like that's there's no reasonable like justification for why you should need to just in case. There's no just in case for $1 billion.
Well, you can't take it with you. Right. Keep that in your brain. You cannot take it with you. So the best thing you can possibly do is experience all these wonderful feelings of who can I help? That's what you want to do in your life is what could I do with my life to help others? To me, that's the most, I consider myself a person that has learned to love unconditionally and to help unconditionally. And I love that. I love that I've gotten to that point. And I'm, of course, financially, I am to that point that I can, can't do it all the time. I don't have that kind of money, but I feel comfortable in learning to be not judgmental, not to see a homeless person on the street and say, well, you must have done something to deserve that, you crazy person. I mean, I don't think that at all. Mm. It just doesn't cross my mind. I just cross my mind of my heart breaks for you. See the movie Nomadland. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Where people could not pay their health care bills and they lose their home. And they eventually choose to just go live in their car because life is so expensive and so daunting that they have to give up everything and go live in this different kind of situation.
Working full-time at an Amazon factory.
Yes.
and doing whatever they can to afford food and gas and all the stuff that they need to make their van home work. But like that's about it because they can't afford.
But there's something to be said for learning to work like that because my husband and I both have story after story after story of the crazy jobs we were willing to take when we were young because we couldn't get work anyplace else. I washed dishes for a whole summer, one summer. I was hired as a waitress. Did that lady let me wait on tables? No. I washed dishes the whole stinking summer and lifted big, she didn't even have a trolley for me to put the dishes on. I lifted big giant bins of dirty dishes the whole summer. And I think I made $300 or $400 because she paid me minimum wage. And I thought I was going to get tips. Well, I didn't because I didn't. But that was one of my, you know, jobs that I can look at and go, I did that, but I did it and I stuck with it and I made the money for my tuition that year. And I know people that'll say, well, I can't get a job that I really like, or I want to get something that I really enjoy. Well, I had to take what I had to take. My husband worked in a fish store one time. I can't remember what it was, like a fish and chips place or something. And he had to work with fish all day long and he smelled like fish all the time. He was embarrassed to date people because his hands smelled like fish all the time.
I think a lot of people understand taking bad jobs when you're young. I mean, that's an experience that this is boomer stuff. This I took us down this road of money. And so I got us in the weeds with this. I took us down. Like I was like, I think I got insecure the second that the St. George home was brought up. I was like, oh no, they're going to think that I'm this spoiled rich kid. And that's why that I was privileged enough to do all this service. But like, so I took us down this road of money. Yes. I've had my fair share of really bad jobs. That's what I've had to do to fund living my dreams and trying to, you know, and it's okay. It's all that stuff. But obviously, like, people who are in their 30s and 40s and like you want a job that you can afford health insurance and have a nice place to live and like eat healthy food and, you know, like, and these things stack up in today's economy and you can't necessarily do that as a dishwasher in this economy. Yeah, yeah, and so I think, but anyway, I've taken us off that path down into the money world. Let's try to come back here and find a landing place. What's some advice that you would give to people who feel like they want to be of service more often in their life than they are, or who maybe feel like they would be of service if they had more time on their hands or if they had more expendable resources or if they this or that other, what, you know, because sometimes for me, it's just like, I just feel like I'm too busy to be of service, or I just have too much going on in my own life. The few spare hours that I do have in a day, I just want to watch TV. What's your advice for like helping people begin like with something simple? Or
it doesn't have to be much. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, my brain, as he was saying this, my brain was just going wild. I had sinus surgery last year, and a friend of mine just called me out of the blue, and it was somebody that I didn't expect to call me. And she said, I remember you telling me that you were going to have this surgery. I just thought about you today and wanted to see how you were doing. Out of the blue. And it took her 10 minutes out of her day. But it really meant a lot to me to think that she had remembered way down the line that I had mentioned that I was going to have this surgery, and she thought of me. And it was so simple. I mean, but I remember it. That's the thing. It meant a lot to me. Another thing that would be very, very simple is to start going through your house and get rid of all your garbage and take it to the thrift stores, because guess what? Somebody else needs it, and somebody else is going to make money off of that, and it's going to serve somebody else's living. So I frequently go through my stuff and give a lot away, or give to my friend that my friend Nan that might need it. She, most of her wardrobe is my clothes, but I don't have a problem with that. I'd much rather have those clothes be worn than sit in my closet and say, well, I haven't worn that for a couple of years.
Yeah. Do yourself the favor of decluttering your space, getting rid of stuff that you don't no longer use. If you got a hoarding problem and you got a closet full of stuff that you haven't looked at in years, gather that stuff up and take it to someone that can use it.
Mm-hmm. That's very easy to do. And those are small things, or like, sometimes I'll see a plant or something, and I'll say, oh, that's so beautiful. Who could I take that to? That's what I think. That's what's crazy. It pops into my head. Not, can I buy that for myself? I'm thinking, who's home today and maybe having a hard day and could use that on their doorstep?
Oh, I can attest to that. I go shopping with you all the time, and the amount of time that I see you look at something for yourself versus the amount of time that you're looking at something for someone else, it's like 98% of the time you're looking for someone else. I could probably count 5 times in my life that I've been shopping with you and you've seen something that you wanted for yourself. Every other time we go shopping, you're first and foremost focused on me because you're with me. So you're like, well, what can we get for you? But then you know the sizes of each of your grandkids, you know their styles, you know what they like. It's crazy.
Not everyone. There's a few that I probably would need to take with me. But I enjoy that. I mean, to me, it's just what I do. I enjoy it. I like to shop, for one thing, and a lot of people don't like to shop. So they look at it as, ugh, that's part of my thing. Like you said with AA, I've got to consciously go and do this. I know a lot of people that hate to shop, so they have to consciously go, maybe I need to go give my grandchild some money because I can't. I just can't, you know. And I know people that literally can't think of what to get their kids for Christmas, so they literally give them money. I like to be able to say, hopefully that child will remember me when they put those earrings on. Yeah. That means more to me that they're maybe creating a memory on top of something else.
Yeah. That being said, you've bought me more than enough clothes in my life, and I do every year just give me money. I have more than enough things that you've gotten me in my life to remember you from.
But they're all the good-looking ones.
Yeah, you're always getting me the best-looking stuff. I got to go and to the endodontist because I think that they might have messed up this root canal they did, and my appointment is coming up, so I've got to go. But I keep just like getting overwhelmed with emotion while you're talking, and I just am so glad that we sat down to do this today because I just love you so much, and I'm so excited to like share you with the world a little bit on this episode. You're just like, I don't think you know what a special person you are, and like what, like how much more than just to your kids or to your grandkids, the people who know you, it radiates. And the people who are listening to this are going to be like, oh my God, what a woman, like what a mom. And like, you really are. You're just the top notch, Julie. You're the best. I love you so much.
And now I have to live up to this. Oh, my goodness.
You do.
And the thing is, you don't understand where we're sitting. We are literally sitting face to face with maybe a foot between us because we have one microphone. So I have a crying son across from me telling me wonderful things that's only a foot away from me. You may as well just kiss me on the face, you know.
It's just funny.
Really, really, can you imagine as a mom hearing that from your child and just love them. I love all of them. They're just, I've got the best kids and it's not our doing. They just came with the most amazing personalities and we just love to celebrate them. So, and our grandkids, they're just amazing. So that's the rewards. That's the rewards of a lot of hard work and love and an unconditional love. Those are the rewards.
Well, I'm so happy. What a gift this is for me and, you know, for your kids and for your grandkids too. It's such, if you never gave me another gift for the rest of my life, having this recording of us talking about this and of my mother talking to me about service and, you know, just reminding me of what a beautiful person she is and was and life she lived, total gift. Thank you for always. I never have to wonder if I'm allowed to come and stay at your house. I was thinking about that the other day. I'm like, I'm 35 years old and I come through Utah frequently for work and for different things. And I'm just like, I'm coming by and I'm going to stay at mom and dad's. And I'm 35 and you're just, your home is always, it just always feels like home for me.
Well, I'm glad that's what it's supposed to be. But this is very difficult for me to sit here and listen to all of this and take it all in. And I don't know if I'll even be able to listen to it back because it's about me and I don't like to talk about me. So it's a lot to take in. It's a lot.
Well, you did a fantastic job, whether you wind up listening to it or not. You did a great job talking about you. I thought your answers were all perfect. I thought this was a very lovely episode. I love you very much. I gotta go. Bye-bye.
I love you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's it. I'm still sitting in the kitchen. She's still here. And I'm doing this outro right after we just did the intro. That's how weird it is. We recorded the interview. I went to the endodontist, had him check on the tooth, make sure it was okay, came back, recorded the intro, and now I'm recording the outro. That's the order. And you're listening to it in a linear sense, but anyway, wasn't that nice? Wasn't that nice to listen to a mother and son talk about nice things and be nice to each other? Didn't that make your heart feel good? I hope it did. I hope your heart feels real tickly and tingly and that you feel really nice and you want to go do nice things for someone today and find a way to be of service in your life. Julie, do you want to say anything else while you're here?
Just that I'm incredibly proud of my son and all the hard work that he does, self-employed, all the hard work that he puts into all this creativity, and the rest of my children and my grandchildren. So proud to be a mother and a grandmother.
Well, you're great at it. Okay, everybody, that's it. That's the show. We'll see you next week. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com or going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. You can look up Austin Archer on Spotify, on Apple Music. I'm on all those things, dude. Patreon.com/Austin Archer if you want to support the show, the YouTube channel, the TikTok channel, the Instagram channel, all the stuff that I produce is supported by my Patreon patrons, who I love very much. They're the wind beneath my wings. I love you all more than I can say. Patreon.com/Austin Archer if you want to support me there. Okay, we'll see you next week, next time, here on the pod show. Love you very much. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.